Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I am Matthew Roth. I am representing Dean and Marcielle Jacobs, husband and wife, plaintiffs, appellants in this action. My attorney registration number is 26929. I request reserve 3 minutes following defendant's appellee's argument for rebuttal.
And I'll try to help you with that, try to keep an eye on that as well, because the clock will keep going until you sit down.
Thank you. Please allow me to give you the procedural mile markers of this case. A foreclosure action was filed in July 2010 against the plaintiffs. The foreclosure action was concluded in January 2011, and plaintiffs were divested of title to their property. The subject action was filed in July 2011. That action is a Rule 105 action to quiet title. The defendants, appellees, filed a motion to dismiss, which was denied. Thereafter, the plaintiffs, appellants, filed a motion for summary judgment, which was also denied. Following that, the defendants filed their own motion for summary judgment, which was granted. Plaintiffs then filed a motion for reconsideration, which was denied by the court below. It should be noted that the motion for reconsideration was heard before the court in a related county court action without notice, that the judge ruled on the motion for reconsideration from the bench without opinion or without analysis of plaintiff's arguments. This notice of appeal was filed in October 2012. There are five issues before the Court of Appeals. The first issue is whether the district court erred in its reading of Goodwin v. District Court, concluding that a foreclosure conducted by a party who is not a real party in interest is simply a miscaptioned foreclosure, which does not affect the validity of the order authorizing sale. The second issue is whether the district court erred in granting summary judgment in favor of defendants, where the court had previously established the law of the case and then disregarded the law of the case in ruling in favor of defendants' appellees on their motion for summary judgment. The third issue is whether the district court erred in granting summary judgment in favor of defendants where there are material facts at issue. The fourth issue is whether the district court erred in determining that the promissory note is a negotiable instrument. And finally, the fifth issue before the Court of Appeals is whether the district court denied plaintiffs due process rights by repeatedly constructing arguments on behalf of the defendant's appellees and then ruling in their favor. Allow me to detail the deficiencies of the district court's ruling below regarding each of these issues. The first issue is whether Ocwen Loan Servicing, LLC, as servicer for CSFB, had standing to initiate the foreclosure action, or more specifically, whether Ocwen Loan Servicing, LLC, as servicer for CSFB, was the real party in interest to initiate, conduct, and conclude the foreclosure action. The Colorado Supreme Court in Goodwin v. District Court established that standing, or real party in interest, is a proper issue to be determined in a foreclosure proceeding. The foreclosure action, like I mentioned, was initiated, prosecuted, and concluded by Ocwen Loan Servicing, LLC, as servicer for CSFB. By its own description and nomenclature, Ocwen Loan Servicing, LLC, was acting as an agent for its principal, CSFB, and not in its own name and not on its own behalf. Ocwen Loan Servicing, LLC, repeatedly admitted in the Rule 120 foreclosure hearing that it was acting as the agent for CSFB. CSFB, by its own admission, has no interest in the mortgage loan and has no interest in the property encumbered by the deed of trust. CSFB has no standing. CSFB is not a real party in interest.
Counsel, what's the prejudice to your client? What's the prejudice? If we were to agree with you, Ocwen has the note, has the original note, has the deed of trust. There's no dispute that your clients are in default. They could simply go back in and foreclose. Where's the prejudice?
Well, I think the prejudice is that they're not being allowed to enforce their rights, or their rights are being disregarded.
What rights are those? There have been no rights pointed out at any point in this proceeding.
Due process.
The
taking of property by a party who has no standing.
The party that showed up in court produced the note. They therefore were holder of an evidence of debt. That's all that's required under Colorado law.
I would disagree. I would say that Ocwen Loan Servicing, LLC, as servicer for CSFB, was not a holder. Ocwen was an agent for CSFB. It has been admitted on the record that CSFB has no standing in this matter and is not a real party in interest.
Would you admit that Ocwen is a holder?
No, I would say Ocwen is a custodian for its principal, CSFB, as was admitted in the record.
I thought, but you said they're not. You just said they're not. You can have it both ways. You said they're not an agent for CFSB or CSFB.
I'm sorry, I must have misstated that. Ocwen is an agent for CSFB.
Okay. And your only evidence of that is what they said in the Rule 120. That's your only evidence of that.
That's an admission, correct? And that's the only evidence that I'm relying on.
And that's since been correct, has it not? There's been a deed, correct?
There's been a deed correcting.
Yeah. So that Ocwen now holds the property, correct?
Ocwen held the property post foreclosure. Currently, the property has been sold and is entitled to another party.
Okay.
Any claim that Ocwen is a holder in Kentucky and can conduct the foreclosure in its own name or on behalf of another is simply erroneous. Again, Ocwen, throughout the foreclosure proceeding, was acting as an agent for CSFB. CSFB had no standing and was not a real party in interest.
Who was the real party in interest then?
Well, after the foreclosure was concluded, it came to light that the real party in interest was I believe it was after it came to light, Ocwen declared that it was the real party in interest, and all along it held rights to the mortgage and to the deed of trust. But during the foreclosure period, which is the applicable period that we have to concentrate on, it represented itself as an agent for another party who was declared to be the owner of the mortgage and had authority to enforce that mortgage and enforce the rights under that mortgage and to enforce the power of sale under the deed of trust.
So hypothetically, had Ocwen foreclosed in its own name, what would your client's position be? How could your clients possibly avoid foreclosure?
Well, there are several arguments that have been put forward in the brief. We would argue that the endorsement, the blank endorsement that gave the rights to anyone who possessed the note, including Ocwen, who could claim that they were a holder on its own behalf or in its own name. We would argue and defend the foreclosure or challenge the foreclosure that the blank endorsement was defective, it was inauthentic and possibly forged.
Well,
so there would still be issues whether the foreclosure was valid.
But that goes to holder in due course status. Cite me some law that says you have to be a holder in due course to foreclose as opposed to a holder of an evidence of debt.
I'm not familiar with any case law at the moment that I could cite for you. getting back to this notion of standing and real party in interest, the Colorado Supreme Court declared in Dues v. District Court that the provisions of the Rule 120 proceeding must be strictly complied with. I think what happened in the court below is that the court played fast and loose with the Rule 120 provisions and concluded that there was no error in allowing Ocwen to foreclose, even though it was admitted that it was not the real party in interest. I think that if we're going to, that we're obligated to follow the law, not only the case law of Goodwin, and as well as Dues, which supports Goodwin, and it says we must follow these rules of procedure with scrutiny, and that they must be strictly complied with. The second issue before this court is that the rule of the case was established early on and then completely disregarded by the district court.
Now, was that based on a motion to dismiss?
Correct.
But on a motion to dismiss, aren't they accepting the allegations as true? And isn't there a lot of fact-finding and development that occurs after that?
Correct. I would give that a little more context in terms of this case, that there was really no fact-finding that happened in this case from the time that the motion to dismiss was ruled upon to the subsequent motion for summary judgment that the defendant's appellees filed. So to me, and as I analyze this, it is difficult, if not impossible, to distinguish the standard of review in a motion to dismiss and a motion for summary judgment in this case, because there was virtually no discovery. There was no fact finding. So he's essentially ruling on the merits of the pleadings.
But it just purported, the ruling simply purported to determine that the complaint on the face of it was sufficient.
Correct.
That's all.
Correct. And the standard of review in the motion for summary judgment is whether the claims are sufficient. And they can go beyond the four corners of the complaint
right, to
pull in evidence. However, the parties had never gotten to discovery. There was never any evidence. We were going on the same set of facts. And so for the judge below to rule one way, and shortly thereafter, and what I argue was ruling based on the same standard, he did a 180-degree turnabout.
You have 2 minutes left, Counselor.
Okay. One of the other issues that I think is critical is that there were facts in dispute that it was inappropriate for the court below to grant summary judgment in favor of defendants appellees. As you read the brief, my client was able to challenge the authenticity and the validity of the endorsement of the note based on the signature and based on evidence that was acquired, public records, that Taylor Binion Whitaker, who was the mortgage originator, had previously engaged in fraud. The person who endorsed the note was a vice president of that organization and had allegations of forgery with regard to her signature. Because because the standard of review for a summary judgment motion is whether the allegations in the light most favorable to the moving party have to be accepted as valid, plaintiffs have put forth allegations supported by evidence which put facts in dispute, or certainly which require investigation and discovery of the facts. So it was completely inappropriate for the district court to rule in favor of defendants on that summary judgment motion. Furthermore, there was a violation of due process. The court didn't even address that issue. There were many other issues which the court created arguments on behalf of the defendants and then ruled in their favor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. I'm told there's a toggle switch here. My name is Mark Willis. My attorney registration number is 31025, and I represent the defendant appellees, Ocwen Loan Servicing LLC, Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, Credit Suisse First Boston. May it please the court. I'd like to actually start by answering, I think, two questions that were raised. First question was from Judge Jones, which is, what is the prejudice to the plaintiffs here? And the answer is there is none. The holder of the evidence of debt is Ocwen Loan Servicing. The evidence of debt is a note. It was endorsed in blank. It was an unconditional promise to make payments. The plaintiffs failed to make those payments. They hadn't made payments since September 1 of 2009, entitling Ocwen to foreclose its interest in the property under the deed of trust, which follows the note, and proceed with the foreclosure under Rule 120.
Well, counsel, I think it's undisputed at this point that Ocwen was, or I guess should not have been, acting as an agent of CSFB in the foreclosure, and that it purported to do so, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, why aren't the plaintiffs correct that the sole status that Ocwen claimed at that particular proceeding was one of an agent and was not acting on its own behalf, and therefore, as an agent, was not the real party in interest? Why isn't that correct? I mean, this is a standing issue. It's kind of a jurisdictional issue.
Well, Your Honor, I think that question, with all due respect, raises something unrelated to what we're here on today. They brought a quiet title action. The quiet title action was to quiet title to the property in their name, and their argument and the law that they were trying to invoke is that Ocwen doesn't have valid title to the property. The question that you're asking is, did they have standing to go into the Rule 120?
Did Ocwen as an agent have standing? I mean, I think it's undisputed that they were acting as an agent, but they should not have been, because CSFB did not have an interest in the note.
Well, Ocwen met the statutory definition for a holder of an evidence of debt, also in any interested party under Rule 120 to commence that proceeding. What we have here is a mistake where there was a comma and as servicer for CFSB. It was a mistake. But the district court in this case got it right when it held that that mistake does not lead to the conclusion that the foreclosure sales should be voided or that title to the property should be quieted in plaintiff's name.
Counsel, what do you do with the strict compliance language that your counterpart says is in the Dues case? Do you agree with that proposition?
I agree, Your Honor, that the strict compliance in the Dues case with respect to notice is in the Dues case, and I agree with that. I believe that if there's due process violations under the Rule 120 statute dealing with notice and eliminating a party's right to be heard, that, that would be grounds to set aside the foreclosure sale. That's not what happened in this case. In fact, the issue of agent of CFSB was not raised at the Rule 120 here. There were other arguments that were presented by plaintiff's counsel. The second question that I wanted to answer was Judge Kopelke's question of who is the proper party, who is the right party, and it's inherent in my response to Judge Jones, it is awkward. We're here on a summary judgment motion. The only undisputed fact in the record is that Ocwen had the possessed the original note and the deed of trust, presented it to the court, and also presented it to the public trustee. If the plaintiffs were going to dispute that, they had an obligation under 56 to come forward with competent summary judgment evidence, not argument of counsel, but specific facts supported by affidavits in the record that would show that Ocwen's interest in this property that it didn't hold wasn't the holder of an evidence of debt. That's not in the record, and the proper party that foreclosed is Ocwen LLC.
Mr. Willis,
yeah.
To what extent is Ocwen's status as a holder of an evidence of debt dependent upon the validity of the endorsement in blank?
Two responses to that. Whether Ocwen is the holder of an evidence of debt is dependent as you follow the UCC. And certainly what we have here is a note that's endorsed in blank. Under 43201B, if an instrument's payable to a bearer, it may be negotiated by transfer and possession alone. And when it's endorsed or endorsed in blank, it can be transferred by possession alone.
So what if the endorsement in blank is fraudulent?
Well, my response to that is there is not any competent summary judgment evidence in the record that we have a fraudulent endorsement. What we have is an argument that was made by counsel with unauthenticated documents submitted in a motion for reconsideration after the summary judgment was ruled. With respect to what do you do with a fraudulent endorsement, I don't know. I haven't researched that issue. I don't believe we have one here. But certainly there's no dispute that the plaintiffs executed the note. There's no dispute that the note was presented to the court, and it's no dispute that Ocwen presented the note to the public trustee to foreclose. And in fact, the plaintiffs aren't arguing that we didn't possess the original note or that we aren't a holder of evidence of debt. Their new argument is that perhaps the stamped endorsement is not valid. That gets to a couple of other arguments I just briefly want to address that were made by counsel. Here, with respect to the issue of the dismissal under 12b-5 being rule of the case, as Judge Kopelke recognized, the court was under rule 12b-5 is under a different standard than it is under rule 56. Under rule 12b-5, it's just testing the allegations of the complaint to see if it states a valid claim for relief under rule 8. Under rule 56, the court, the party that moves under 56 needs to present evidence that can be outside of the record, and the court here did that. I don't believe there's any case law, I didn't see any in the briefs that support the notion that a ruling denying a motion to dismiss would preclude a party from filing a summary judgment on that issue later. And in fact, if that was the case, I would be in a little bit of trouble because I have a number of motions to dismiss that get denied and are later taken up by the court at summary judgment. With respect to plaintiffs' arguments about disputed issues of material fact, I believe the court was clear, and it was short in the record because there was no competent summary judgment evidence that came forward presenting disputed issues of material fact. In fact, I think the court in its order cited to People ex rel AC saying a genuine issue of material fact precluding summary judgment cannot be established simply by allegations in pleadings or argument. That was exactly what opposing counsel said to you when you had asked about the note. We have an argument, but they don't have any evidence. Real quickly, Your Honor, with respect to the due process violations, I think there seems to be a little bit of confusion about what due process rights are available. The plaintiffs were given multiple opportunities. They were given notice and an opportunity to be heard in multiple forms. They were given that in the Rule 120. They were given that in this court, in this action, both on the heads of oral argument, which is rare, but oral argument on some of the motions, as well as oral argument on the motion to reconsider, albeit that came in the FED action. They also have been given that opportunity in the other actions that they've filed associated with this case. So with those arguments in mind, I believe the summary judgment order from the district court should be affirmed. I believe it is accurate and correct. There was a mistake with respect to adding the line, comma, as servicer for CFSB, but that mistake does not lead to voiding the foreclosure sale, and it certainly doesn't lead to quiet title in favor of the plaintiffs.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.